The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 341 for Monday, July 11th, 2011.
To the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab, the show where you send in your questions. We try to provide answers to the questions. We all provide each other with some tips. And in the end, we all learn a little something more about the Mac. Here in Durham, New Hampshire, I'm Dave Hamilton.
Here in Fairfield, Connecticut, John F. Braun.
You're getting a little more specific, John. For those of you following along, Mr. Braun has gone from, I think, did you say the universe first and then planet Earth? And now you've kind of been narrowing in on where you are. I guess you'd have to have listened to not only the regular shows, but the premium shows to hear the evolution of this. But
yeah, I'll dig one level deeper, kind of like a Inception.
OK. All right. So we'll keep going with this. Maybe in the end, or one of you could put together a little snippet of all of John's descriptive locations in a row together, because that would be an interesting thing to play. So if anybody gets inspired, there you go. There's an idea. Submission to the show.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. You know, I promised at the end of last show, which was 340 Premium, that I would talk a little bit about where I went last weekend. I went to Fish's Super Bowl IX Festival, and there's a couple of things that were relevant to what we do here, going from, AT&T service was fantastic there. I asked the festival organizers how many people were there. They said there were 30,000 people all crammed into this one racetrack. And AT&T service was so good that I was actually able to do a FaceTime call over 3G. Yes, my iPhone was jailbroken. A FaceTime call over 3G with my son, who was at my uncle's house, actually, in Maine. And it worked flawlessly. Plenty of bandwidth. I was able to show them around the campsite and everything. So they did something right.
So what did they do? Did you see? I would imagine that if anything, they would bring in temporary mobile
antennas. Yeah.
Okay. To provide, because yeah, I mean, you only have a fixed number of clients that you can serve on any one tower. So
I was imagining there's a maximum. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Oh, well, yeah. That was nice.
So it was good. You know, it was nice to see, because I've been to things like, you know, other concerts or sporting events or whatever. And, you know, as people fill in, service gets worse and worse and worse, but whatever they did up there, they did a great job. So I just, you know, there is hope for our wireless phone carriers, it seems. And then
3G, and you got 3G service.
I had 3G service. Yeah. Yeah. With obviously plenty of bandwidth and decent latency. I mean, we were just having a normal video chat. It was totally fine.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cause I was as a little aside, I've noticed this now on the Verizon, but I was doing a bit of a biking and all that and hanging out at the beach this weekend. And I did notice at one of the beaches I was at, and I actually sent a few photos, but I noticed at one point now some of you who have any device, I think when you see the 3G, that's good. When you see the little circle, that means you're getting substandard cell coverage.
And then of course, AT&T people have a middle ground where it says E, which is their edge coverage. So yeah.
But I noticed that I was at a location and I was trying to do some Instagram and send some photos, nice photos of the beach. And at first where I was at, it showed a little circle and actually the upload failed, but then it clicked over to 3G. So some of it, I think, just has to do with where you're at, because I moved a little bit closer to, you know, civilization, and then it got better. So
interesting. Cool. And then of course, Small Dog Electronics, as they have, I believe, for previous festivals, donated and helped out with a bunch of Macs at what they call the House of Live Fish, which is a cool little thing. It actually is cool. They air condition this tent, and you can go in, you can listen to some music, you can copy some of their live shows over to your iPhone or iPad. And they even had some station set up where you could remix tunes and stuff, but it really was just a great little place to hang out. So it was cool.
Fish is kind of like the Dead. They don't mind live recording.
No, their whole fan base was built by, you know, by that. Yeah.
Very nice. And Small Dog. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was good. Like
they're
Small
up
Dog
in New Hampshire, right?
They formed in Vermont, but they do have a store now here in New Hampshire. So, So those were the semi-related things that came up. But we have a lot of questions to get to, John. And so I want to get to those, but I do also want to mention our first sponsor for the show, which is Smile at smilesoftware.com and their PDF pen software, which is really, really cool. It's one of those pieces of software that I use all the time. It's for the Mac, obviously, or maybe not so obviously, but it is for the Mac. You can open a PDF in this. You can rearrange things. You can edit the PDF where you can highlight text and actually change the text of the PDF, but it still stays in the form of the PDF. And then the thing I use it for probably more often than anything else, sometimes I use it to fill in forms, not PDF forms, although I could use it for those too. Preview will typically do those, and that's what PDFs open in for me. But you can fill out non-PDF capable forms or non-form capable PDFs by simply placing text on top of the PDF. So you just place it in the spot where you'd want it to be on that form and it's there. And then of course you can paste in your signature too, if you've got that scanned, and it makes for a great experience filling out a form or a contract. If I need to, you know, fill in some stuff and sign it, works awesome. PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro are available from smilesoftware.com. They both have a free trial, of course. And then once you're hooked, $59.95 for PDF Pen and $99.95 for PDF Pen Pro. PDF Pen Pro will also let you create forms. So if you're creating PDFs, you can do it right there. So this is all available. The place to start is smilesoftware.com. And with that, we'll let Pierre ask us the first question here. Pierre writes, the info page on Lion at Apple.com states that a Core 2 Duo or Xeon processor is okay amongst others. The About This Mac info pane on my Mac tells me that I have a dual core Xeon processor. The confusing part is that the general comment is that a dual core processor can't be upgraded to Lion. However, this appears not to be the case if it is a Xeon class processor. My guess that this is because it is because the Xeon is a 64-bit processor. Bottom line, I think, is that if you have a Mac Pro, you can upgrade to Lion. But I'm a little confused. And I think what's confusing Pierre is he's confusing the term dual core with core duo. Now, fair enough confusion point to make, right, John? But the core duo processor can't be upgraded because it's only a 32-bit processor. This was on the first MacBook Pros that came out. They had a Core Duo. It was a dual-core processor. But the Core 2 Duo, which came out a little bit later, can be upgraded in most cases because it is 64-bit capable. Am I getting that right, John?
I'm with you. And to add to the confusion, Dave, having worked with Intel processors, there was actually a Core Solo for a while.
Oh,
but really? but you bring up a good point, and I think the whole issue here is 32-bit processor versus 64-bit processor,
right?
And what do we mean by that? And I don't want to get into a lesson here about processor architecture, but I do want to touch on this because I did find a page at Intel site that I think really summarizes what you want to look for here. And what you really need, I think, as you mentioned, is a 64-bit processor. And to me, I just want to, to educate the audience here, what is a 64-bit processor? And I found a page on Intel's site, which I think succinctly describes this. And we will, of course, link to it in the lovingly handcrafted show notes that I will put together. But it's called the Intel 64 architecture. And it touches on two things. One is the amount of memory you can address, and the other is the size of the registers in the processor. And that's what the Intel 64 architecture covers. So one, it has to do with memory addressing, which I still have mixed feelings about that because some people define 64-bit computing as being able to address 64 bits of memory. And I don't know if I totally buy that that's 64-bit computing, but having the ability to address or deal with information in 64-bit chunks, I would say, is definitely what I consider 64-bit computing. And all other things being equal, if you can deal with information in the same amount of time in 64-bit chunks versus 32-bit chunks, then you're going to get a performance increase. And that's really what's being said here. And it's confusing because Xeon doesn't have... Xeon is a 64-bit architecture.
Okay.
As is the Core 2 Duo.
Right, so. Right. Cool. Well, that got way geekier than we usually do in question number one, but that's good stuff.
I wanted to geek out because it is confusing because the problem is they use the word core.
Correct.
And it's confusing because some core products are 32-bit and some are 64-bit, but I think we just cleared that up. And then Xeon is its own more server class, and those, as far as I know, all the Xeon things are 64-bit.
Okay.
Right?
I believe that's right. Yeah. All right, back to Lion. Corey sends in, well, this.
Hey, Dave and John. Corey here. I'm just testing out this brand new iPhone app that I happened to stumble across, and I thought I would send in a tip for the imminent Lion release. Anyway, if you're like me and you've got a bunch of Macs laying around the house and at the office and family members that you play IT support for, you don't necessarily want to go download Lion, you know, several times and then have to install it on each computer. That sucks. So instead, if you just download it on one computer, go find the Mac installer that you downloaded from the App Store on using the Finder. It's probably in the Applications or Utilities directory or somewhere in there. Shouldn't be too hard to find. If you right-click on it and click Show Package Contents, then go to Contents and then Shared Support, you'll see a disk image, install esd.dmg. And if you drag that into Disk Utility, you can burn it to either a DVD, or heck, these days you can get a 4 GB thumb drive from the grocery store for less than $10. And now you've got your brand spanking new Lion install, either thumb drive or DVD restore disk, and you can use that to install Lion, or you can keep it around for a rainy day in case something happens to your hard drive, and it works just like the old Snow Leopard disk, so no problem. Anyway, keep up the good work, and have a good one.
Thanks, Corey. You rock. And that's a great little tip, because that would be a pain in the neck, especially if you're paying for your bandwidth. So that's good to know. And looks like Lion will be out, certainly within the next 3 weeks, because Apple said July.
Now, my recollection, Dave, is that if you do download from the App Store the Lion installer, I do believe you should be able, on any other Mac App Store enabled computer, you should be able to take that file itself and bring it over as well. Is this your...
Yeah. I think it needs to be a Snow Leopard machine, but yeah, you can just take that file and run it. Needs to be on an HFS Plus volume if you're going to do that, if you're going to move it around. So right. be careful moving it to your network drives. It will not run if it's on, you know, some like I put it on my Drobo and it wouldn't run. But as soon as I copied it back over to an HFS Plus volume, then that file ran. Of course, we're talking about two slightly different things. Corey's talking about the burned disk image, which is inside this file that resides in your applications folder.
Which I'll call the Lion installer, which is downloaded from the App Store.
Right. And that sits in your applications folder. But the trick is you can't install Lion and then go move that file, because it will be deleted during the installation process. So you got to get it before the install completes.
I'm hesitant, Dave. Maybe we shouldn't go down this path, but I don't know if I'm ready to jump in immediately to Lion.
I am, actually.
I give you my
but there's good reason to be hesitant, so yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'll give you my my capsule review is that it seems OS X Lion seems to be iDevicing Max a bit too much for my taste. As far as the UI and just some of the other features, now I know there's a whole bunch of other features. And of course, if you go to apple.com/macOSX/what's-new/features.html, you will see the 250 plus new features, which I'm looking at right now, which is why I could read that to you. And we'll link to it, of course. But the UI enhancements concern me, because I'm not entirely comfortable with all of them. Now, I know you can switch some of them off to make it more Mac-like, but that's my initial take on a lot of the UI-based aspects of Lion.
Yeah,
a lot
of the other things are great. The scrolling and both the scroll bars and the mouse direction. The mouse direction thing I got used to pretty quick. In fact, I don't even think about it anymore. Even moving from machines running it to machines not running it. I tend to adapt.
Yeah. So to me, there's the technical plumbing things and then the UI things. The UI things, I'm not that crazy about. The technical things, like, I think, if anything, I mean, for what it costs, I mean, File Vault 2. I mean, to me, that's just that should have been done in the last version and they fixed it. So that in and of itself, I think, is especially in this day and age of, you know, security scares and just securing your data and who knows where it's going to go and all that. That in and of itself, I think, is worth the price of the OS. So,
yeah. That's a good point. That's a good point. Yep.
All right, go. I'm sorry. I just had to pontificate because I've had more than one person via Twitter or other means say to me, you know, I'm not really crazy about the UI aspect of Lion. And I don't think I'm alone.
No, I don't think you are, but I think it's one of those short-lived things. I think it's just, you know, I will
learn to love it.
Yeah, we all will, right? Apple dictates that we'll love it and you just get used to it. I mean, right? There's always little things like that. It's like, oh, I missed the, you know, double scroll bars or whatever it was. And those actually did come back. But, you know, little things, you're like, yeah, it's not there. Okay, move on. It is what it is. All right. Kyle emails and writes, recently, Mac drivers for my printer were released. Now, finally, I can plug my printer in without a PC. After trying to manage all my USB devices, I need some help with what things I need plugged into my Mac and what things I can plug into a hub. I have a 2007 Mac Mini, which only has 4 internal USB ports. I have a USB hub with 4 ports, a Logitech headset, a Logitech keyboard, and a unifying receiver for the mouse. And on the hub, I have another iPod cable, the printer now, which has its own power source, and my Time Machine backup drive, which also has its own power source. So, John, you're our Mr. Power Consumption here. Go.
Well, I'm going to start here, but I'd like to toss it back and forth. So I actually did find, being all about the Apple support knowledge base, HT4049. They have an article, Apple Computer and Displays.
Okay.
Powering peripherals through USB.
Good.
So, and that was good, but I think in general, the guideline you want to use here as far as how to arrange your USB peripheral. So when you have a machine that has a USB hub within it, which I think basically all Apple computers do, even though it may be a port, I think you call it a USB hub, but I think in general, they provide 500 milliamps of current. And, you know, I'll be clear here. That's current. Amps are a measure of current.
Right. You know,
there's power and voltage and all that, but they provide that much current. So I would say as a general guideline, when you're trying to think about what you want to plug into your computer, well, if it has one USB port, then that's easy because then that's just one. And as long as the peripheral doesn't consume more than 500 milliamps, which I don't think many do, then you're cool. When you have multiple that are spread across a hub, then you got to be a bit careful. Now, the good news is that if you go into System Profiler, when you plug a device in, as long as it's configured properly or the driver is configured properly, you will see the amount of current that it's going to draw. So I'd say in general, you may want to make a little chart and just take each of the devices. So when we got this email, it listed each of the devices. So what I would say is plug each one in, go to the System Profiler, see what the device reports as its requirements, and hopefully it's correct. And just make a note of that. And as long as it doesn't exceed for any one port 500 milliamps, then I think you're cool.
It's good.
The only other thing I want to mention is that when you're talking about an external hub, now there's two types. Now, one is what we're going to call bus powered. And those, I think, are kind of dangerous because the problem is they're really not buying you much except as a virtual extension of what's on your computer, is that they draw on the current that is available on the computer itself.
Yeah, that may be right.
So all they're buying you, similar to a USB hub or a USB switch, well, that may not be a good comparison, but power-wise, they're not buying you anything because they're drawing on the power of whatever they're plugged into. And if you plug too many things into it, you will reach this current limit. And a lot of times, maybe...
That's a hub that's not self-powered, just to be clear.
Correct.
Right. It's just adding ports, but not any more power capacity.
Right. And you bring up a good point. So I was going to differentiate. So you have two types of hubs. One is a bus powered. And what I mean by bus powered is that the computer itself is providing the power to the hub.
Right.
So it's basically extending the power or the current of the hub. The other is, of course, as you're saying, Dave, is one that has an external power adapter, in which case you're starting fresh. So the only caution I would offer is that if you're using a hub without its own power supply, then you got to be careful because you may be exceeding the capabilities of the computer itself, because you're basically just creating virtual a virtual extension of what's already in the computer. And then you could easily exceed the 500 milliamp limit.
Yeah, especially if you start stringing hubs together, and which I've done. You know, I've had like 10 devices plugged in. But, you know, it depends on what you've got. You know, in his case, to get to Kyle's question, adding the printer is fine. It doesn't matter because it's bringing its own power source with it. So really what you need to be careful of are the things that don't. But, you know, in my case, when I had, you know, I had some USB extension thing, and so I wanted to have all my stuff on one side. So I just ran it out of one of my USB ports on my MacBook Pro. And I think I had like 11 things, but many of those things were not live at any point in time. I have, you know, had two iPod dock connector cables because sometimes I like to use both, but most of the time I use none. Right. You know, and the same, you know, there was just lots of things. So I think if I'd plugged everything in all at once, it would have been a problem, or turned everything on all at once, it would have been a problem. But,
right.
You know, so just
right.
Yeah,
actually, what are you saying? Wisely. So he's listing the devices that he had. So he says Logitech headset. OK, I'm going to assume that deserves a little power. Not a lot.
Right.
Logitech keyboard. OK, sure.
You know. Yeah,
a little bit, and then a receiver, but I suspect, because he hasn't seen a problem, is that the combination of them do not exceed.
Right. Right. Now, the printer was the only thing he was adding to it. And so, you know, I think he's fine. I think he's totally fine. All right. You know, the next question we got is pretty interesting. Barry wrote us a little while back and said, okay, with Lion coming, I went to System Profiler to see what apps would have trouble under Lion. Everything in System Profiler works, except every time I select applications, I get the spinning wheel followed by a crash. I've sent to Apple, but of course that's like sending into the Roach Motel. Same thing happened on a new and little iMac. Cleared caches with Onyx, but I'm at a loss. And there was a crash report. And we went back and forth with Barry on this, suggesting, to go delete System Profiler, plist files, and this, and that didn't work. And finally, Barry stumbled onto it on his own. What he said, he tried Disk Warrior, everything. What he did was he went into the Finder, selected System Profiler, which I believe is in the applications/utilities folder. And then he checked open in 32-bit mode. Lo and behold, everything worked just fine. When he went in there, he found that there were quite a few classic apps. He deleted those, and then he could go back out, uncheck the open in 32-bit mode, and sure enough, System Profiler ran just fine even when he clicked applications. So there were some of these classic apps, and he didn't say which ones, that were causing System Profiler not to display application details when in 64-bit mode. So I know a lot of you are going to be going through and checking your apps, and it is a good thing to do, as we've talked about. So if it crashes, we wanted to share that little tip as to why that's going to happen. Fascinating, though. And I never would have. I would love to know what led Barry to try that.
He must have listened to an earlier podcast.
Maybe. Yeah, that's right.
I mean, I even offered you can run System Profiler from the command line or the terminal, as a matter of fact. And even that failed, which kind of shocked me.
Right.
Because that's a way to do it that actually circumvents some of the UI processing that you get from the GUI version. And right. Even that crashed. So to me, that was like a deep-seated embedded problem apparently, well, one of these apps were just not written right.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, hats off.
It's good troubleshooting. So, yeah.
Excellent.
All right. Sponsor number two for this show is Circus Ponies with Notebook. Circus Ponies Notebook is available for both the Mac and the iPad. The idea behind Notebook is you create little they don't have to be little. They can start little and they can grow basically as big as you want. Little virtual notebooks for topics or maybe events or projects or whatever you're doing. You can create these little notebooks. You can type right into them And it's just, it looks like white lined paper. It's a very familiar interface. And then you can pull other data in. You can pull in JPEGs. You can pull in PDFs. You can pull in audio files. And maybe you have a, you know, a class you're taking and you recorded the lecture, and then you're in there and you got all your notes right there along with the lecture. The cool part is you could do that on your iPad and transfer it up to your Mac, maybe do some edits on your Mac, send it back down to your iPad. It's a two-way sync between the apps on the two devices, and it really lets you do some cool, cool stuff. Of course, once you've got data in the app, you can tag it, you can put keywords on it, and then you can search for it using anything you remember about that piece of data. It could be, I know I did it last Tuesday, or I know there was something that I mentioned for my friend Kurt, but I can't remember what it was. Well, now you just search for Kurt, and boom, up it comes. So Circus Pony's Notebook for the Mac is available as a free trial from circusponies.com. Once you are hooked, it's $49.95, so spend $50, save a nickel. And Notebook for the iPad is, of course, available at the App Store because that's how it works. And it's $30, save a penny for $29.99. But the place to start is circusponies.com. And then Steph wrote us. Steph says, I have a Mac Mini running 10.6.8. The other night, I downloaded a single .rar file from a file serve. It was supposed to be an audio file. When the file finished downloading, I double-clicked it and the file disappeared. My downloads window was still open from Safari, and when I selected the download file to open, a drop-down told me that it could not because it was no longer in the downloads folder and it was moved. Do you guys have any thoughts as to what happened? John F. Braun, go!
No.
Okay. Okay.
No, of course I do, but first you may ask yourself, what is a RAR file, Dave? Because that's kind of obscure.
Is it an audio file of a lion making its morning sound?
RAR. No.
Oh.
How was that?
Yeah, you got it. Pretty good.
No, but RAR, and actually, yeah, I got the Wikipedia. Rochelle, I didn't even know this, Rochelle Archive, huh?
Really?
So it's a proprietary format, but I think that the main thing it's used for is when you have a file you want to break up in pieces, or just a file you want to distribute, it's a way to archive a file similar to zip and other things. And as far as I know, Dave, this is a format that is handled by the OS if you double click on the file and you try to decompress it. I think that is what was happening here.
Yeah, RAR files, anytime I've pulled them down, and they do, you know, they're I guess people use them a lot for music files or large audio files too, because one of the things that RAR does and what I think it's most commonly used for is to take one large file and break it up into several small chunks, which of course was very, very popular back in the day of, you know, downloading over a modem dial-up connection. But again, even now it can be helpful. So right. Yeah.
And you'll see that in the extension is that I think typically it'll have .roo, .ro1, .o2, and those are the pieces of the file. And yep. Somehow magically, I think the first file knows, oh, there are more of these that I'm going to expect. And when you click on me, I'm going to bring all the others into me,
right,
and create the whole. But yeah, it's because of the limited file size that you had with news groups and email and stuff like that.
Right. That's right.
So,
but I think what's happening here is that the system saw that and instead of having all these files, it pulled them into one and decompressed it. And that's why it disappeared. I think everything's okay. Right. I mean, to answer Steph's concern, right?
What I think. Yeah. And what I suggested, what I think happened was I suspect that, well, I wonder if does he mention Safari? Yes, he does. So Safari, I think Safari may have considered it a safe file, and I think it may have automatically decompressed it.
Right.
And disappeared it on him.
Right.
Now, the way you could find out, of course, is to go into Safari, Preferences, General, and disable open safe files. And then when you see that file, I would get info on it and see what application is set up to handle RAR files. And actually, in the case of one of my systems, it's actually StuffIt. But I think on Mac systems, there's something buried deep in the system in system/library/core services called Apple Archive Utility. And I suspect that may have grabbed it and decompressed it. And yeah, when I think that happens, then I think you lose the link to the file in Safari.
Right.
So I don't think it's a virus. I understand the concern that, yeah, all of a sudden something that was there disappeared. But I think it's due to decompression by the system and not some nefarious virus.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Back in show 339, we talked about, Mark will help us. Mark says, in show 339, a listener was wondering if there was a way to play unsupported video formats on the Apple TV. There is. You need to use a combination of two programs, both of which are free. The first is Air Video Server from InMethod.com. And then you point Air Video Server at a folder of videos and it can convert them on the fly and send to an iPhone or iPad with the Air Video app installed. To make this work with the Apple TV, you also need to install Air Flick, which is something Erica Sadoon made, which links to the Air Video Server and sends the converted video stream to Apple TV using AirPlay. Once the video starts playing, you can control it with Apple TV's remote. The setup is a bit odd, but it's been working well for me for the past few months. All right, cool. Thanks, Mark. That's that's convoluted, but it gets the job done, right? That's the part that sucks, is we're living in this, you know, world where it kind of has to be convoluted. And I think Apple gets that, but I don't think they want to roll out. I think that's part of what this iCloud, you know, thing is eventually built to solve, is your media everywhere and you don't have to. You don't have to jump through these hoops, but hopefully they get that right. We shall see. And any comments on this before we play Michael's comment on the similar topic?
Just that there are a lot of other streaming server options out there, and it seems Apple may have to play a little catch up, because I've seen I wouldn't even get into it because there's a number of them.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, I could actually. I have to dig through my notes for some of the events that I went to, but there are quite a few people out there that have other streaming media solutions that I think are not quite as closed. So.
Right. That's true. Yeah, Roku's got, you know, their thing going, and Seagate's got one too that I've had the opportunity to check out. And they work well.
While we're at it, let me look at my stack of stuff here. Let me see.
Yeah, you look through your stack. There. Let's hear Michael's comment and we'll come back to it.
Hi, Dave. Hi, John. Hi, Pete. This is Michael in Garland, Texas. On show 339, James asked about streaming his vast collection of TV and TV shows and movies from his Mac Pro to his Apple TV. If he doesn't already know about it, he should consider Plex. That's PLEX. It's at plexapp.com. What Plex is a server and a client. They can run the same machine, different machines, and it can stream TV shows and movies from one to the other. The server does a great job of going to the internet and scraping all the metadata about your TV shows and movies. It downloads high resolution artwork, full screen posters, banners, even theme music for TV shows in some cases, and then serves all that up to any number of clients. Clients can run on another Mac, on an iOS device, or on an Apple TV if it's jailbroken. And the client just gives this gorgeous full screen, you know, couch friendly interface where you can click on movie posters and watch a movie. You can scroll through episodes of TV shows as you hear the theme music for that TV show, and then pick an episode to watch. You get to see the synopsis, all the other factoids about the movies and TV episodes while you're looking through them. Anyway, it's gorgeous. Check out some demo videos on the website or on YouTube. Also, I don't have an Apple TV, so I have never tried jailbreaking one or installing that client, but it's worth considering if that's what he's looking to do. And that's it. Bye.
Cool. Thanks, Michael. And yeah, the Apple TV 2 is, from what I understand, jailbreakable. So if you're willing to head down that path, that gives you a couch. What did he say? Couch capable. That was good. I like that. All right. So you found a couple of others worth mentioning, John?
Well, I got one here. Have you heard of a Slingbox, Dave?
Oh, well, yeah, that's a whole different ball of wax, right?
But I like it because their claim is watch your TV anywhere.
Right.
And at least at the event I was recently at, well, they got an iPad app.
Yeah.
So their claim is, hey, if you got an iPad and you got media, and you want to stream it to your device. So my understanding, it's basically a streaming solution.
It is. Of course, Slingbox's claim to fame, this is interesting because I hadn't really thought about it in the way that you're talking about.
Okay.
You're talking about using it on your local network, at least potentially, from wherever your media is to your iPad. But Slingbox works a little bit differently. Unless they've changed it, their whole idea is that they stream from your TV to whatever either computer or device you want to watch it on. So it's streaming just the picture, you know, and the audio. It's not actually streaming the data,
right.
But I mean, it's converting it to data. So it's taking the signal. It acts as though it is your TV, right? It gets in the way. It interfaces with your
sure.
Apple TV or your TiVo or whatever you've got, your cable box, right? It sets up right. as though it's a TV, and then it, instead of displaying it locally, it streams it off to whatever device you have. But if somebody sits down and turns on your TV, they'll see the same thing you're seeing, even if you're in a hotel room in Ohio.
Yeah, my take was that no matter where you are, which I think is their claim to fame,
right,
whether it be in your home or
yeah, it's
traveling,
true. That's right.
You can stream the content from your device, whatever,
from your,
you know, whatever it may be,
yeah,
to your, and I think it's relatively new, or at least they were showing it at the show, was, hey, you got an iPad, you want to stream your TV shows on your whatever,
yeah,
to your iPad, you can watch it. So I think that's kind of neat, and I think it may coincide with some other solutions, but I thought that was neat. And then I got to find they announced an alliance with some other folks, and yeah, let's get back cool. to the show, and I may have more for that.
Okay, cool. All right. You know, while we're on that subject, Chris had a semi-related question. And Chris asked, what software do you guys use to stream video to the TiVo HD from your Macs and also to pull video off the TiVo to your Macs? Do I need Roxio Toast? The TiVo preference pane seems like it only allows streaming of pictures and music to the TiVo. Maybe I missed something. All right. So, John, why don't we take this back and forth, but you start.
Hold on. Who do we have here?
All right. I'll take it and I'll hand it to you. So, I'll let John address the TiVo pref pane in a minute, but as far as streaming to the TiVo, I use an app. It's a free app. Called Pi TiVo X, PyTiVox. And if your TiVo supports it, which Series 3 H and HD TiVos and Premiere TiVos do, you can stream the data to it. Otherwise, you can use that to copy the data into your now playing list, the show. But what's cool about Pi TiVo X is if the data is stored on your Mac in a format that TiVo can natively interpret, it just sends the native data and it doesn't try to do anything funny. However, and there's only a couple of formats that TiVo supports. So if you happen to have a file that's not in a TiVo supported format, Pi TiVo X will transcode it on the fly as it beams it off to your TiVo. So you could very easily play a video of an unsupported file format directly to your TiVo as soon as you got it using Pi TiVo X. And it's awesome. It works great. We use it constantly. We stream all of our movies to the TV with it. We don't, that's the only way we get movies to the TV now is through the Pi TiVo. So it's cool. And then,
cool.
And then getting movies back, I use iTiVo, which is also a free app. And that'll pull data that TiVo allows anyway, it'll pull it back from the TiVo to your Mac, and you can set it up in a bunch of different formats. So it's good. But he mentioned the TiVo pref pane too, John, and.
Yeah. And that's the lowest common denominator, but it's free and that's good. So the, and they call it TiVo desktop, but it's a pref pane, but here's two ways you can get to a secret feature. So one, and this answers the question, how do I get stuff from my computer to the TiVo? So one, if you start up, at least my experience, Dave, with the latest version of it, the pref pane, if you hold down the command key and then click on the pref pane,
yep.
Normally you will see a music and a photos tab. But if you click on the command key, you will then see a video tab.
Ooh.
Now, of course, the other way is you can go into and I guess this is fiddling with the the pref file, but you can actually fiddle, and you know, I'll put a link to it in our show notes, of course, but you can fiddle this to be a permanent option. But then what happens is that if you have a video on your Mac in MP2 format, and this is why it's not the greatest, but again, it's free. At some point, if you drop a video, from what I recall, I haven't done this in a while, Dave, but if you drop a video onto your Mac, at some point, it'll realize, oh, there's a video here, I should push it onto the TiVo. But the only limitation, which I think is kind of limiting, yeah, is it has to be MP2. The other solutions, I think, are much better because they do all the transcoding from all the other formats, so you don't have to do any work ahead of time.
And I found that the TiVo app was a processor hog. Now, I have a huge iTunes library. No, it's like always running at like 9 or 10%. No, it's crazy. Because it just sits there all the time. And so I turned it off, and it was because it was constantly reparsing my iTunes library. I don't know why, but I guess just based on the size of my iTunes library, it would chew up a ton of RAM and a ton of CPU space. So I used Galleon, Galleon, to stream music to my TiVo. And that works out really well. It's another open sourcer. Yeah. Yeah. I'd forgotten all about that. I got so used to using it that I forgot I was even using it. But it's nice, especially at Christmas time when you want to consolidate all the Christmas songs and pop them over to the living room. All right, Jed, what have you got to ask?
Hey, guys, this is Jed. I actually just left a message about one issue, and I'm leaving a completely separate one. Huh. So two calls in 2 minutes. But I've been having an issue for about 2 to 4 years with iTunes, and it won't quit. That's not true. It does quit. It just immediately restarts. When I do a software update, I need to kind of sit on the force quit and force quit about 5 times before it will finally even take that it quit to do the software update. There used to be an issue with iWow, I think was the name of it, and I read all the instructions and got rid of that, and that fixed it for a little while. And I checked the dashboard thing. I think you had talked about that in a previous episode to make sure nothing was running. And I don't see anything. My dashboard's not running on that Mac, actually. And, you know, I am connected remotely from here and there, but I've tried disconnecting everything. And what's weird is even after I force quit, you'd think when I restarted and quit again, nothing's connected yet. So it would be fine. But no, that doesn't help it. I have yet to try doing it with a different user in the same library, maybe I should try that. But besides that, I just cannot figure out for the life of me what it is. It's just annoying. It's not earth-shatteringly bad, but it doesn't quit. And I looked in the console, and it doesn't say a thing. It just says shut down or force shut down, depending on what I do, and that's it. Sometimes an iPod is connected, so I tried disconnecting iPods. I tried disconnecting the iPod dock, everything. So, I wonder if you had any ideas. Kind of not expecting one, but I thought I'd reach out and ask you guys. Thanks for the show. My info.
All right, and we'll cut you off there. So, yeah, so this is interesting. You know, my first thought, of course, John, was, well, let's check the console log, because something has to report. And I still feel like there's got to be something out there, because it's some job is triggering, right, to cause iTunes to start up. The ideas I've got on this one are check launch agents and launch, you know, and maybe use Lingon to take a look at launch D. Lingon is a program that'll let you manage the whole system launch D process, which is kind of the granddaddy of everything. So or reinstall iTunes. Right.
I mean, I suppose you could use a nice, as we've discussed, a nice app deinstaller to get rid of all the cruft.
Would that work for iTunes? I guess it would.
From what I've seen, these apps are pretty good. So whether it be, you know, I think the two favorites we have are App Cleaner or App Delete. Dave, you mentioned Hazel or what's the other?
Mac Keeper. There's tons of them. Right.
Yeah, between those. So there could be some cruft. Now I'll suggest something else, Dave.
Yes.
Which I hadn't even thought of until we started the show. But hey, you know, sometimes I'm inspired. So pref panes. There's a pref pane that I really, really like called default apps. And you know one thing it does, Dave, is it shows you. So this may be part of the troubleshooting process. I don't know if I can give an answer here. But one of the things is that in this pref pane, so it has a number of... So this pref pane lets you dig into the guts of the OS to see when you do this, what happens, or what applications map to what extensions, or what extensions map to what applications. And the thing is, Dave, this shows there is a tab that has apps. And one of the apps listed in this, Dave, is iTunes. And if you click on iTunes under the apps thing in default apps, you will see a list of URLs, UTIs,
yep,
and file types that launch iTunes. So you may want to look at this just to see what, if anything, is causing iTunes to launch, because that's, to me, what's happening. There is a document. Somebody somewhere is launching a document that iTunes thinks it should open. And that's what's happening.
Yeah, it's either that.
Or it's a place to start.
Yeah. I think he mentioned that he had iWOW installed, which is a plugin or an enhancement for iTunes. And I wonder.
You could whack that with an uninstaller. Yeah. Maybe there's some cruft there that's just, maybe it's being...
Well, he said he uninstalled it and he went through the process to uninstall it. But, you know, if that was causing this before, that's the first place I'd start, even if I was certain I got rid of it. Because, you know, if that's a known source of this issue, that I would definitely, you know, check that out. Maybe reinstall it and uninstall it again, just so that, you know, it puts everything out there and sets it the way it's supposed to be, and then unsets it as it pulls it all out. So that's all I got. Gazelle.com, John. Our third sponsor for this show.
Awesome.
It's so much fun. Just visit gazelle.com and start typing in the names of your devices that you kind of have. We all have these, right? The pile of old, you know, maybe an old iPod, an old cell phone, certainly. Maybe you just upgraded to to a Verizon iPhone, and you've got like your old Motorola Razr that's not really that old. Well, you can probably get some cash for it, right? You just go and type this in. It doesn't cost anything to go and search Gazelle. In fact, it doesn't cost anything at all until you send them your stuff and they pay you. You go there, you put in what you got. It asks you some questions. Do you have the cables? Is it damaged? Does it work? Et cetera, et cetera. You go through that and then they'll tell you, okay, if the device is what you say it is, this is what we're going to pay you for it. If you want it, say yes. They'll, they'll cover the shipping and they'll pay you. And it just works. And if they get it and decide the condition's different, either better or worse than what you said, then you have the option to bail out or take whatever their offer is. So it's gazelle.com. Highly recommend it. Lots of fun. And gazelle.com. It's just fun to play with. Every month when their sponsorship comes up, I always think, oh, yeah, I found that other device. Let me see if I can send that off to them. And I go and I look and I find, like, oh, great. Cool. $20. Great. Gazelle.com. It's $20, you know, but sometimes it's more, right? I mean, it depends on what it is. You know, if you send them an iPad, you're probably going to get, you know, $200-$300.
Well, and I saw them in my travels, my media travels, Dave.
Oh, you did? Cool.
Well, they're very popular.
Yeah.
No, for popular devices, I mean, people love them.
Yep. Yeah.
Quick and easy. Yeah, that's the feedback I got.
Yeah. Yeah, it's good stuff. All right. Another iTunes question here, John. Richard writes, I recently made a corporate purchase of Final Cut Pro X or 10 from the Mac App Store with my company credit card. At the time I made the purchase, I had a personal iTunes gift card balance of $70. Surprisingly, the Final Cut Pro 10 purchase grabbed my personal $70 credit from the iTunes store and only charged the difference to my company credit card. I filed a problem ticket with the iTunes store and was told this was standard procedure and that the only resolution is to get a $70 refund from my company. As you might imagine, this will be a huge hassle for me. Why should macOS 10 App Store purchases have anything to do with iTunes store account balances? How is it possible to keep personal and corporate transactions separate in the OS 10 App Store? So here is the crux of the question. You might be tempted to suggest setting up a separate iTunes account for the personal and corporate purchases, but I already gave this a try and it did not work for me. Every time I connected an iDevice, I'd get an error message that claimed the device was linked to another account and it would be wiped if proceeded. Okay. So You're right. You want to set up separate iTunes store accounts, but there's no reason that those have to then sync to different Macs or different devices. And of course you're talking about Mac apps, but you talk about that the device would have to be wiped. So clearly you've been through this before with iOS apps too. You can have multiple iTunes accounts feeding apps into the same device. I do it constantly. My wife and I each have an account and we don't buy the same things. You know, she buys it, I copy it to mine, I buy it, she copies it to hers. In fact, we have iTunes home sharing doing that automatically for us. And it works. It's no problem. The only problem is that, you know, occasionally I have to put in her password when updating an app, or she has to put in mine, vice versa. But iTunes will see it. So I think what it sounds like you did was you created separate iTunes libraries for the different apps. And that would cause you you can only sync your iDevice to one iTunes library at any given point in time. But that's not necessary. You can have different iTunes accounts managed from within one copy of iTunes. And in fact, if you go to the iTunes store, so you go into iTunes, you click on iTunes store in the upper right, it'll show you the email address of the account that you're currently logged in as. You can change that. You can just click on it and sign in as a different account, and it works just fine. So that is your answer, Richard. And I think that will solve it, at least, you know, going forward. It won't help you with the $70 you got to squeeze out of your company, but I'm sure in the end they'll cover it. At least I hope so.
Any thoughts on this? I'm thrilled here, though, because my thought is as follows: is when they launch the App Store, I noticed this due to my little pal, little Snitch. They are, as far as I can tell, at least at the point that they initially launched the App Store, they are basically using the iTunes payment infrastructure.
Oh, yeah, that's right. The Mac App Store and the iTunes Store, it's all the same. It's one account.
Because I saw when it made an attempt. So when I started the App Store and it made an attempt to go reach out on the network, it was connecting to blahblah.itunes.com. And I was like,
right. Okay.
So, I mean, it makes sense for Apple to do that. They have an established payment infrastructure through iTunes that's huge.
Right.
So and why make another
accounts.
One?
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So why create another one? On the other hand, one of the downsides is what we just saw here with Richard, is that it may draw on funds from
what
some may consider the wrong account. So.
Right.
So maybe a finger
in his case,
Apple to, I mean, no, I think there should be an ability, Dave, I don't know about you, but to have separate App Store and iTunes accounts, one for music, one for apps.
You can totally do that. You could just set up different accounts. That's easy. His complaint was
No. If you're using this, are you saying if I use the same Apple ID, I can set up separate accounts on the App Store and iTunes?
No, but you just go into the App Store and choose sign in and use a different account. You can be logged in iTunes in one and the App Store is the other.
Do you see what I'm saying, though?
Yeah, you can't use the same email
address. I would like the ability to use my Apple ID for iTunes purchases and App Store. And I think that's what he's saying, and I don't think that's possible now.
He totally can.
Yeah.
He can totally
do
that. Yeah. It works fine. It's the same account. His iTunes credit is his App Store credit. It's everywhere. No, his issue was that his basic issue that he's trying to solve is that he had a gift card balance and Apple.
I understand.
Apple spent that before he was ready.
Right. What I'm saying is that the as far as I can tell, there is not a separate App Store repository and iTunes repository.
Correct.
Okay. That's what I'm saying. And I think maybe that should be the case.
Good luck with that.
Well, that's why I'm saying maybe it should escalate from a finger wag to a fish shake at Apple.
Well,
no,
why would
I mean,
you want
some
this
people,
different? Why do you, I mean, why would you want different accounts? Why would you want, why
Dave,
would you want,
I would like to give you a gift of music. I would like to give you a gift of applications.
Okay.
Should I be able to differentiate those or just lump them all into one? I just see it as a shortcoming
A gift card?
Correct.
Oh, yeah, it's just right. It's just the iTunes store gift card. Just like the Amazon gift card, you can't pick what people are going to buy with it. Right. But if you wanted to give me the gift of a particular app or a particular piece of music, that you can do. Right. Because you could buy it and then.
All right, but do you see where I'm going?
No, I don't. I don't see why you would want these to be separate and yet related to the same email address. I mean, it's. I think it's a very limited use case.
All right. We're in different worlds then. Yeah. I may want to give somebody just the gift of apps or music.
But
I guess you're not seeing a need for that.
You want to give somebody a gift card to go buy apps.
Correct.
But they get to pick the app.
Sure.
Okay. So you're not, you don't want to give them a specific app as a gift. You want to just give them cash that only can be used for apps.
Correct.
Yeah. I think a very limited use case. Gift cards are stupid anyway. I mean, it's, you know, it's like, I couldn't really think about your gift. So here's money, but you can only spend it on the things I want you to spend it on.
That's do you see where I'm going here? Come on.
No.
Work with me, man.
Okay. All right. Yes. I see where you're going.
All right. So you're saying, all right. So any gift card to any Apple store should be applicable to any Apple store that they offer, whether it be iTunes or App Store. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm with you. All right.
Yeah. It's just, and if you want it to be different, I mean, it's gift cards. It's stupid anyway.
Nah. All right. What's next?
Giles. Giles writes, I'm the proud owner of a new 27-inch iMac with a souped-up i7 processor, 8 gigs of RAM, and two drives, a 256-gig solid-state drive and a 1-terabyte spinning drive. It sounds like somebody had a good year. Giles continues, my experiences with an SSD in a MacBook Air convinced me to go for this option as it's lightning fast. The argument for dual drives makes sense to me. OS apps and preferences, the nuts and bolts, if you like, on the faster but smaller SSD, while the bulk of your content, documents, media, etc. lives on the spinning hard drive. Indeed, Apple themselves makes a deal out of this on the iMac store site and says, if you configure your iMac with both the solid state drive and a serial ATA hard drive, it will come preformatted with macOS 10 and all your applications on the solid state drive. Then you can use the hard drive for videos, photos, and other files. Giles continues, however, they offer no guidance as I can find as to the recommended way of doing this because the SSD comes with all the system files, OS applications, and most crucially, user home folders. It means the default location for everything, including music, documents, pictures, and movies, is the SSD. So how to move these over to the hard drive, ensuring that the default save locations are to the hard drive, but without botching up the home folder for the OS to work seamlessly. I should also mention that my current setup involves keeping most of my raw media on a 2 terabyte external hard drive, and this runs many hundreds of yards, runs to many hundreds of gigabytes in size. Looking online, I've seen mention of using symlinks to the individual folders, something I'm happy with as I've been using Symbolic Linker with Dropbox for some time, or alternatively going into System Preferences and selecting the advanced option on a user account to be taken through the slightly scary looking window where you can move the default location of the user folder. The solution, which involves moving the entire home folder, sounds like a more complete solution, but won't there be stuff in the library and Aperture libraries, for instance, that would benefit from being on the much faster SSD? Okay. And then he talks about how he phoned AppleCare. He says, so I have three options. Leave everything on the SSD and move my stuff at a later date if capacity becomes a problem. Keep documents, music, pictures, and movies on the hard drive and create symlinks back to the SSD, and or move the whole other user folder to the hard drive. Okay, so those are your three options. And of course, he left open for us to fill in number four. So this is good. It's actually good that Apple's selling things this way because it sets you up for what you're going to want anyway down the road, which is, you know, a fast drive to boot from and then a large drive to store your data to. And the two need not necessarily be the same drive. But it does make it interesting. I'd stay away from symlinks as much as possible. For iTunes, you can actually change the iTunes media folder location in iTunes. And if you want, you can have it move the files for you. There's a knowledge base article about this that we'll link to. But if you go into iTunes Preferences Advanced, you can set the iTunes media folder location there. So you can just set that to be on your 1 terabyte drive. And then every time you launch iTunes, it's going to see that and you're happy. Ensure on that same preference panel that the keep iTunes media folder organized and copy files to the iTunes media folder when adding to library are checked. The knowledge base article that we'll link to has instructions on actually moving your files over. You can either copy the iTunes media folder manually, or you can go through the whole consolidate files procedure, which will copy them from iTunes, but then you still need to go back and delete them from the disk, from the original disk. And then with iPhoto, you can do something similar. So iTunes will let you point to wherever you want for your music. iPhoto, mm-hmm. you can do the same thing. If you hold down option key, right, when you start up iPhoto, it'll let you create or open an iPhoto library that lives anywhere. Or you could also use iPhoto Library Manager from Fat Cat Software to manage if you wanted it in multiple places for whatever reason. Will Aperture do the same thing, John?
Absolutely.
Okay, good. That's good. Is it the same way?
I'm pretty sure it's the same way. So you're saying option.
Option when you launch. Yeah.
Well, we'll try it right now. But no, the same thing. So a lot of the Apple apps will... Oh, here we go. I just launched Aperture. Held it down. What library do you want Aperture to use?
Perfect.
Yes. Yeah, the answer is yes. So, and especially Aperture or iPhoto or the other, iMovie, similar. I think all of them let you do this, Dave.
Yeah.
Is to say, okay, well, I want to put my library or, yeah. So you may have to do, so it may not come that way, but you can change the behavior of the app to look somewhere else for the library. So.
Yep. As far as documents, you know, there's no reason you have to go and put things in your documents folder in your home folder. You could create a documents folder elsewhere. I happen to create mine inside my Dropbox, as I've talked about. And what I do is I create a Finder shortcut, a Finder sidebar shortcut. I just drag my documents folder over into the places in my Finder sidebar. And I call my folder Dave's Files, and I can click on it and it brings me there. And it doesn't really matter whether it's on one drive or another or what. It just works. And you can do it with subfolders of it. So I navigate my Finder using places. And then at that point, it doesn't matter where the actual data is stored. It makes life pretty easy for me. I don't tend to have a problem with it. You could use default folder as well.
Oh, sure.
You know?
Oh, that's our favorite. But I would say in general, I mean, when you're thinking about file size, I mean, that's where you're going to get the big boost from the SSD. So for things like Final Cut or iMovie, definitely, I would say if you're doing anything of any size, sure, put that on the SSD. Photos, yeah, if you got a big library, same thing. iPhoto or Aperture. Like you're saying, Dave, documents?
This is actually kind of backwards from what he wants to do. He wants to store his big stuff off elsewhere, if necessary. But, you know. And that's what I do.
I'm just thinking through it because, if I was going to, well, it's a good discussion. I mean, the SSD is fast, but it's limited. So yeah, you got to value.
Yeah. Maybe only keep current projects there, you know, and archive your other stuff off so that you've got room. That's actually a really good idea.
Maybe. No, I'm thinking about that. Yeah. I mean, you could store the, you know, the Wampen projects.
Yeah.
Yeah, like you said, with a lot of things, you got to weigh, you know, I mean, performance versus, I guess you got to weigh the size it's going to take versus the performance that you want. I mean, for big Wampen projects, you may want to have them on the SSD because you're going to get the benefit of the speed. On the other hand, they're going to take up a lot of the space.
My guess is that most people will need somewhere between 100 and 150 gigs for your system and all your apps and, you know, to breathe easy. Which means that if you're willing to actively manage it, you can probably get away with, you know, running easily off of 128 gig SSD. But, which means for Giles here, maybe that's going to leave him with a couple hundred megs or at least 100 megs worth of quote unquote play space, you know, on the SSD.
Sure.
So, you know, that's probably enough for at least most of the projects that you're going to work on.
Yeah. I think as we're hinting at, so active projects, the things that you're working on,
right,
you may want to put in the SSD. And then when they're in the background, then you archive them to the rotational hard drive.
But your music and stuff, your iTunes library, absolutely keep that off on the regular hard drive. You do not need the speed there. The files are small and you're not streaming. You're not looking to get that data really any faster than it can play. So for your music files, that might be 256 K per second, right? If they're 256 K files, geez, even a 3.5-inch floppy could probably deliver at that rate. But I mean, seriously,
a what?
Yeah, I know.
Who are you?
Yeah. Can we talk about elephant branded discs? Anybody remember those? All right. Speaking of all that stuff, you know what? Let's jump way back. We have a couple of cool things found, but because I mentioned elephant discs, we're going to jump all the way back to the oldest reaching one that we've heard recently. Damien writes, I'm a little behind on listening to Mac Geek Gab, but I'm catching up one per day. In your wrap up of Emacs versus VIM, it was mentioned that there was a Ferris game in Emacs. There is, although I forget the switch as to how to open it. There's another game in Emacs called Who Done It. The command line is Emacs space dash batch space dash L space done it, D-U-N-N-E-T, and it's a text adventure. The game is what I use Emacs for mostly. I was introduced to and still usually use VIM for command line text editing, although I use TextWrangler 99% of the time. So that's pretty cool. A little game hidden inside Emacs. That's I love this stuff. This is
as far as I know, Emacs, I think, actually has a compiler built into it. I mean, Emacs is the kitchen sink of editors.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you want to get old school, to me, Ed is the editor that real men use, and women, right?
Yeah. No reason why not.
It's really, right? It's really not an editor at all. Very minimal.
Very minimal.
Again, Emacs and VI. Yeah, we can't touch that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go.
All right. And then lastly, Jeff wrote us with something called he says, coming from a Windows environment, I'm used to locking my personal computer at work every time I get up from my desk for security reasons. When I switched to a Mac 2 years ago at home, I wanted the same feature, but never really looked too hard for it until now. The other day, I discovered a new Mac OS X app that lets you lock your Mac called Lock Screen 2. That does the job nicely. Okay, it might not be new, but this new version is new to the Mac App Store. Lock Screen 2 locks your desktop, just like on a Windows PC, but with what looks like an iOS device lock screen. You have the time and date at the top, your customizable wallpaper, and swipe here to unlock bar at the bottom, which is also customizable to say anything. Now you might ask yourself, swipe to unlock on my Mac? Yes. To swipe, you use the keyboard to swipe, and that is also customizable. So that's pretty cool. Thanks, Jeff. That's we like that. That's fun stuff. It's $1.99 in the Mac App Store. So go check that out. They say it's regularly $4.99, but now, you know, on sale now. Special today only, but not just today, John. You got anything else
The poor man's version of that is you go into Preference Security General, require password immediately after sleep or screen saver begins.
That's true.
So, yeah. But no, it's nice to have a program that does this because, yes, you never know who's going to come by your computer That's all I'll say.
Yeah, that's true. It's
all
true.
I know is when I was working in the corporate workplace, yes, we would take interns who would not listen to us, and we would do various things when they were logged in.
Yeah, that's fun.
Not for them, but for the rest of us. And then they would learn, yes, you lock your screen. And yeah, it's good practice. If you're going to walk away from your machine for more than 5 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah, lock it. Well, unless you're in a house alone. But if you're in a corporate workplace or a household, I don't know. Depends on how much you trust your family. Anyways. Speaking of family, Dave, you know, I consider everybody who's listening to this to be our podcasting family. And, you know, a lot of things families do is they keep in touch. And if you want to keep in touch with us, Dave, one thing you could do is you could get on the telephone. And how would you do that?
The best way to call is 206-666-GEEK, which, John, is
4335. And you can email us. And if I wanted to email us with a question, a comment, praise, criticism, whatever, I would send an email to feedback@macgeekab.com.
Yeah. Feedback@macgeekab.com.
No. Feedback@macgeekab.com.
You can Skype us at MacGeekGab, and you can send in your iTunes comments. We can't reply to them, but we can see them, and all the other potential listeners can see them, and that's a good thing, especially when they are positive and encouraging. We certainly appreciate that. So,
and there's more, Dave. Oh my gosh, there's. Well, for now, you know, it's kind of trendy right now, but Facebook, facebook.com/MacGeekGab. But in addition to that, Twitter. On Twitter, Dave is Dave Hamilton. I am John F. Braun. Pilot Pete, who is not here, but he's flying somewhere, somehow. Pilot Pete, news about the podcast is MacGeekGab and Mac Observer. And who else? Oh, well, of course, Michael Johnston.
Yeah, and he's Michael Johnston. He's the man who creates the AAC for us. It doesn't get any better than this, folks. Yeah,
well, we could have 3D VR-based MacGeekab, but...
I don't know about that, John. 3D VR-based? would our listeners actually want that?
Let us know via one of the previously mentioned feedback mechanisms.
Cashfly.com does provide all the bandwidth. We certainly appreciate that. The podcast marketplace includes the A5 desktop speakers from Audio Engine, Yojimbo from Barebone Software, PDF Pen from Smile, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and Drobo. Have a great week. They're actually going to be back later this week. Don't get caught.